afternoon. This is Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and welcome to the Weekly Pulse Sunday podcast. We've got a great show for you today, and I'm, of course, joined by a great contributor to the show, Mr. George Grombacher. George, how are you, bud?
I am doing fantastic, man. Thank you so much.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
And I'm a little sad today. Are you sad because Natalie's not here today?
You know what? I was trying to put my finger on the emotions I was feeling, and now that you bring that up, yes, it does feel like something's missing.
But I think she'll be back next week. You know, she went to go pay her family a visit in Georgia and, do some family things, and I think she's entitled to that, obviously. But obviously, last week we talked about the Worldwide Developer Conference that Apple is hosting or did host this week. So more on tech coming up, I guess, next week. So that just leaves time for you and I, George.
Perfect.
And cue the music, George. just you and I, right? So what was top of mind for you this week? I know you're out talking to clients as an advisor servicing retirement plans. What's top of mind for you?
Top of mind for me this week was how it's so important to understand and define for yourself what it means to be wealthy. And wealthy is subjective, but that doesn't mean necessarily financial wealth. It could mean deep ties to community or a healthy family, whatever it might be. Take the time and figure out what that means to you. And frankly, shut out everything else, because what's happening on the national stage is really not going to have that great of an impact on you and your family. And we get one crack at this deal. So take the time and figure out and define what it means for you to be wealthy. And I think once you have that, then you can move forward in a more positive fashion. So
that's, I think that's just a good life lesson. I don't know if that's a financial lesson per se. I mean, it's broader than just, hey, I need this X amount of dollars. I think it's like, what is going to make you happy as a person? And that is part of your planning for your future and identifying goals, I would imagine. I love that. It's good food for thought. Because remember, as they said in Different Strokes, what might be right for you may not be right for some. What might be right for you may not be right for some. So,
no doubt about it.
Bringing in the 80s sitcoms. I think this is a great business, obviously, retirement and, learning. And it is a continuous learning experience for all of us in the business to try to pick up new – you learn something about yourself and you learn something about how to deal with other people. I appreciate that you're kind of taking these different angles on your podcast, The Money Savage.
Yeah. And it's pretty interesting. I'm sure that we're going to talk with some of our guests today, but with Starbucks in the news, doing their implicit bias training and shutting down their stores for several hours, all of them, to train their employees, and Howard Schultz, at least from my perspective, wanting to be a positive force, not only for selling great coffee and creating a great experience, but for social good. And I just saw that BlackRock's CEO was talking about how corporations must pursue social good, and impact investing has been in the news a lot, and sustainable investing. So, I think it's great that corporations are thinking about that. I frankly haven't dug deep into it enough to know what the long-term implications will be. I don't see how that's bad. But people just need to also figure out what they want their impact to have also. Otherwise, if you don't think about that stuff, you're sort of swept along. So
yeah. Well, I think that's great. I think, it's interesting. This podcast, when we first started it, we really kind of had this narrow – I think we started – the thing has evolved over time, but this narrow focus of educating – continuing to educate the marketplace, whether you're a plan sponsor, whether you're someone in the industry like both of us, or someone responsible for a retirement plan or participating in a retirement plan. And we keep on finding these different nuances or angles, for lack of a better term, to talk about. And I think this is just another example of that. So I'm really privileged that we're all kind of working together as a unit. People are contributing their time, participating and educating and doing this really because for the love of the segment of the topics that we're covering.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and think that the whole idea behind any thing that you're putting forth is to help people become more successful, to help people better understand their situation. And in order to do that, you do need to take different angles at it. Otherwise, you're just part of the same, you're part of an ocean of sameness. And I don't know too many people that want to do that. So,
yeah,
and on top of that, I think that the old ways, and I talk about the same stuff all the time, which could be annoying for some people, but until things start changing, I'm going to keep doing it. And I don't know that the old ways of helping people to be financially successful have been all that effective. So changing the frame on some of these things, I think, is necessary. So
I like that. And it's a perfect segue to our first segment this week. Last week, if you recall, we talked about the Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association and P&I magazine, which is a magazine that covers the asset management industry. They've kind of come together to honor innovators in the retirement space. And so our first guest this week is going to be Amy Resnick. She's the editor from P&I to tell us a little bit more about that. So I think that'll be really interesting. And then we've got some other, in addition to our contributors, you know, we have Noah Zuss, who's coming to us from, who covers the marketplace for Fund Intelligence. And then we have Beth Bell, who we've had on the show before from the U.S. Senate, who will talk to us about what is going on Capitol Hill. You know, we do have the legal eagles, but it's always nice to hear people that are kind of also in the trenches, so to speak, kind of working on tax policy or working on regulatory or legislative ideas. So really looking forward to this show.
Yeah. Yeah, that will be interesting to hear from Beth. I know that Kevin and David do an incredible job.
Absolutely.
But from a different perspective, where I feel like she's mixing it up with the actual legislatures on a pretty consistent basis. So maybe we can get some dirt out of her too.
Well, I think that's highly unlikely. She's a she's all business. But,
yes, yes.
You know, it's great to have her on, and I guess let's just get started. So we're going to start off the show. We've got a great guest. She's the editor of Pensions and Investments magazine. We're joined by Amy Resnick. Amy, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
Excellent. I'm doing great. George, you doing okay?
Yes, sir.
It's the weekend, so everyone's kind of happy.
Almost
the weekend. We're working for the weekend.
Absolutely.
Last week, Amy, we mentioned the call for nominations for the Innovator of the Year. This is a Defined Contribution Innovator of the Year. This is an award that you're co-sponsoring, if that's the right word, with Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association. And we're glad you joined. If you want to, you know, share a little bit more, I just kind of covered things from a very high level. But since you're one of the co-organizers, maybe you can kind of share with the audience your perspective on the award.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. These awards started out as the Innovator Awards, you're correct, but a couple of years back we decided to rename them as the Excellence and Innovation Awards because we realized ourselves and the group from DSEA realized that we were getting nominations in sort of two separate categories. Some were people who were truly doing things that had never been done before, were innovating, and as a result, helping their plan participants achieve better results when it comes to retirement income and adequacy of resources in retirement. But there were others that were achieving those same types of improved results by doing things that had been done before, but doing them at such a level of execution, such a high level of excellence in their implementation and their attention to detail, that also was noteworthy, even if what they were doing was not brand new. So we don't have any specific categories in this program, but entries will be considered both for their innovation and for their excellence, and could be considered a winner in either category. But again, anyone who's entering, any plan sponsor who is entering, or any consultant who wants to nominate someone, keep in mind that we are looking for both ideas that are wholly new and innovative, and as well as ideas that are being executed at such a high level that they are improving the outcomes for the participants.
That's great. And people can go to the pionline.com/innovationawards2018, if I got that all right. And
that is
that,
correct.
That sounded right. So they can go and log in there, or not log in, but and make an entry there.
Yeah, they can access the nomination form there. And people can nominate themselves. People can nominate a colleague. People, as I said, consultants can nominate a client. It's a fairly open process. And we have recognized everything from, in the past, from the California State Teachers Retirement System, won an innovation award last year for a massive revise of their 403B Compare website, which allowed teachers in the state to review 403B plans. But then another winner was from BP for putting together a financial wellness program that linked their financial and healthcare programs together, that improved savings plans and was accessible both to their participants and the spouses. So again, financial wellness is not brand new, but the way that they were doing it was so high quality that the judges felt that it deserved recognition. So it can really be a wider range of programs that might win. Yeah.
And George, what I really like about this is what Amy's and the team are doing. It really provides that roadmap. You know, it's not theoretical, right? It is, this is practical. Like, I mean, it's like, these are people that have done some significant things and they've been, here are the results, and they've done it at such a high level, and people can kind of take away, you know, kind of build their own path, but use some, leverage some of this.
Yeah. It's awesome to tell and hear success stories all the time and to take some best practices. And hopefully there's some good artists out there that copy, and hopefully there's some great ones that actually steal some of these ideas as well. So
that's actually one of our goals. We try to hold things up that we think people can replicate and use to their advantage, and ultimately to the advantage of people who are saving for retirement,
which is at the end of the day what we're trying to do. So
absolutely.
I love it. Well, Jeff, you and I
absolutely
were talking a little bit about when we got started here, the BlackRock CEO coming out talking about how corporations need to provide real social good. And Amy, I just read that that this business roundtable came back with some suggestions saying that maybe businesses should be taking a much longer term look for the benefit of long-term investors.
Yeah. The Business Roundtable, which is the, you know, D.C.-based group, D.C., Washington, D.C., not defined contribution-based organization for the biggest companies in this country, led by Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase, this week said that they think it's important to look at long-term growth of companies to evaluate companies for investing rather than quarter-over-quarter returns, and that emphasis on the short-term profit may not put the right emphasis on where to look for value and growth and creating investment returns and wealth for people over time. So it's a new idea. I mean, we're all used to the idea of the quarterly analyst call and the CEO or the CFO of the company getting up and discussing what went well and what contributed to their growth in the most recent quarter and what their projections are for the next quarter. But at this point, some of the most seasoned executives in the country are saying that short-term thinking may be unhealthy for public companies and financial markets, and that quarterly earnings performance can reporting of quarterly earnings performance can provide incentives for short-term profit-taking at the expense of long-term strategic investments by those companies.
Just hearing that, it certainly makes sense to me that you would want these big companies that so many of us invest in through our 401ks to be taking a really long-term view, instead of, not to say that these companies are, but taking shortcuts just to make a quarterly number look better to investors. So theoretically speaking, or conceptually, that certainly makes sense.
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, Larry Fink of BlackRock earlier this year has advocated for moving away from a culture of short-termism in favor of long-term value creation. And, you know, one of the country's most well-known investors, Warren Buffett, along with the Business Roundtable yesterday, made a point of saying that shareholders, investors, companies, and the U.S. itself would be better served by focusing on long-term results and the fundamentals of companies rather than on short-term performance. So, you know, I think we all are in it for the long term and hopefully a long and healthy retirement. And, you know, in order to have the resources for that, the companies that we're investing in hopefully are focused on the same type of goal.
Excellent.
And it's certainly an interesting perspective to hear from these senior executives at this point in time.
Where can people learn more about, I think that I found this on your website, but what is your website?
Our website is www.pionline.com. And yes, there is an article on the Business Roundtable and on the Excellence in Innovation Awards, if people are looking for them. And I'm sure you could also go to the Business Roundtable's website and see what they had to say about it as well.
Well, Amy, we thank you so much for coming on, and we hope you had a pleasant experience dealing with George and I. You know, we don't have Natalie Walters, our other co-contributor, on, who kind of launches the show with us, but hopefully you had a good enough time that you might be willing to come back and check in with us with other great articles and topics that you're covering as an organization, as a periodical each week.
Absolutely. Yeah. Give me a call. Happy to participate. You guys are fun to talk to.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
And that was Amy Resnick from Pensions and Investments Magazine. It was great to talk to her, George.
Yeah.
You know, she's very informative, and they do so much great work over at P&I to cover the institutional and defined contribution and defined benefit marketplaces, and among other things. And now joining us is a friend of the show, tax counsel at the U.S. Senate, Beth Bell. Beth, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How about you?
I'm personally fine. It's Friday. I'm actually in Florida today, so the weather's nice, a little sticky. And I think George, I'm not going to speak for George, but I think he's doing okay, too.
I'm always doing awesome.
Very good.
That's good. And before we begin, I know we want to check in with you on the Hill, but I just want to say for our audience that Beth is appearing on the show, and that what she says doesn't necessarily represent the views and opinions of Senator Ben Cardin, the senator with whom she works. So I just want to get that out there, and we're just going to have a fun, friendly conversation. You know, Beth, we talk to our legal eagles. That's what we call them on the show. David Levine and Kevin Walsh, we're actually going to talk to them a little bit later on about what their perspective is. And this is the first of a back-to-back week and, 2 weeks where we're going to be talking to you and Kara Goetz from the House of Representatives. But I wanted to get your perspective about what's going on the Hill as it relates to tax and retirement policy. So any updates you might be able to pass along to us and the audience?
Of course. Yeah, well, I'm happy to chat about generally what's going on over here. It may seem like we're not processing much on the floor on the Senate side, but I think I've said in past recordings, and I think this is still true, a lot goes on behind the scenes. In terms of tax and retirement items in particular, as you know, Senator Cardin is a member of the Senate Finance Committee. There's been a lot of activity recently around the idea of a tax administration package. The House reported, the Ways and Means Committee reported out a package in April, and I believe the House passed that package shortly thereafter. So on the Senate side, we're interested in producing kind of a Senate response to that. I think that will be kind of a fruitful area for discussion going forward over the next couple work periods. And people are still interested, you know, in retirement items in general, not only in the tax administration context. I'm thinking kind of the EPCRS fee increase, for instance, and ways to address that, which would be considered a tax administration item. But also looking at improvements to retirement policy, low-hanging fruit that could be gotten done, say, in a lame duck session. And of course, there's always hanging out there, even though, you know, I will not dare to make predictions. Well, I will if you ask me, but on the tax reform 2.0, that's always hanging out there, along with the extenders provisions, which were only renewed retroactively, and also the more technical or smaller corrections to the tax reform bill that passed at the end of 2017.
So even though it's kind of quiet,
there's still a lot going on.
Well, people don't necessarily – I think it's great for you to come on, and we appreciate that greatly, to kind of give the insider's view, because I think there's this misunderstanding oftentimes that, you know, we see the political aspect of things in the news, and we don't always understand that there are staffs of people who are public servants who are working hard, and they're not really – partisan, you know, they're not involved in that. And they're trying to make the business of government go forward. And I think that that's really important for people to understand. It's not just, you know, there's not just 100 senators that are just working. There are all these people that have to work together, and that I know I've seen you on the Hill and at different events, and you have great collegial conversations with your colleagues across the, I guess, quote unquote, across the aisle and across the different legislative bodies. So I think that's very important to understand.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that's right, especially, and we've discussed this before in terms of retirement policy in general. I think that's one of the, to the extent that tax has gotten a bit partisan because of the activities last year, I think retirement in particular remains a very, and happily so, a very bipartisan space.
I love that, George. Retirement is probably the last bipartisan issue in the United States of America.
You know what? I hadn't really thought about that. If it's actually the last, it certainly possibly may.
Yeah.
Beth, I think that you are on one of the first episodes that we did. And now, since then, we've had the opportunity to talk to folks like Lisa Messina, people that are really involved with the state-run retirement plans. And mm-hmm. I think that there are now 12 or so that are up and running, and I'm sure many more to come. Any news on, or rather, any thoughts on how you think that the Senate actually views the states at this point, kind of taking the ball and running with it?
Yeah, right. Well, I think that, you know, we went through that whole congressional resolution debate on the DOL safe harbor for the state-run and the city-run plans. And so there was a broad swath of views at that time when we took those votes last year. Maryland is one of the states that has a plan, and it's been going forward, and I understand it's been a very productive effort. I think you'll still find, if you canvass members over here, with those interested in retirement policy in particular, that they're appreciative of the efforts that the states are putting forward, especially to, you know, address coverage gap in their communities, trying to get increased accumulation for retirement. But that being said, I think there's also a feeling up here, and you see this in some proposals that have been introduced recently, like Representative Neal's automatic 401k bill, that, you know, the states are acting and that's good, but having a federal standard might be a more powerful way to get at this. Especially because the states can create kind of a patchwork of policies. And so if Congress could act in this space, I personally think it would be a very good thing. We're interested from the perspective of our office on working on something like that would encourage employers on the federal level to adopt plans, much like Representative Neal's bill, the automatic 401k bill that they have over on the House side. There's kind of that tension between the way glad the states are doing something, but recognize the need possibly for federal action in the future.
Interesting. And I'm always honest. I don't know about that. Who is Representative Neal? What state is he from? Or he or she,
Representative. I apologize. So Representative Neal is the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, and he is from Massachusetts, and he's had a long-term interest, just like Senator Cardin, in retirement policy.
Got it. Well, I will have to check that out, because my finger is not on the pulse, obviously, hard enough, so I need to dig into that.
Well, you know, there's a lot going on. I think that's why you know, we come together every week to talk about all the issues. So, you know, it's nice that we can do that and highlight things like this, because I think what's interesting, Beth, is that, you know, we're here talking about, you know, you have expertise in tax policy and retirement policy, but these retirement plans have so many different pieces to them. And I would imagine that, you know, you are obviously very well informed. You have studied, spent a lot of time studying, but you know, you've got to rely on your colleagues at the Labor Department and across the whole, you know, the SEC, they all have to weigh in on the various components of the retirement plan industry, I'm imagining, too. So you all have to, it's not just the U.S. Senate or the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives or the various committees. Now you've got the executive branch that you're working with, or the SEC and the Department of Labor, the EBSA. So there's all that goes into this. And I think, George, you just underscore the need to really come together in a forum to share ideas and how important that can be to collaborate with others.
I agree 100%. I mean, it really is an ecosystem up here in terms of retirement policy or any other policy. We coordinate with agencies to the best we can. Those lines of communication, you know, sometimes they could be more open than they are, but at the same time, there is, you know, talk about keeping your finger on a pulse. It's like trying to keep your finger on 20 pulses. there are a lot of groups. Fortunately, I think there is a lot of opportunity to collaborate, as you say, and that ultimately, I think, makes for better policy decisions.
That's awesome. Well, Beth, we certainly thank you for coming back.
And thanks, Beth.
Obviously, yeah. Hopefully, this was not too torturous. We'd love to have you back. And next week, we're talking to Kara Goetz, your colleague in the U.S. House of Representatives, and getting her opinion. So, thank you, and hopefully, you'll come back in a few weeks or a few months, and continue to update the audience.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye, Beth.
Bye.
Welcome back, everybody. That was Beth Bell giving us an update on what's going on Capitol Hill. Joining us now are Kevin Kelly and Oliver Rennick. Kevin from Bloomberg and Oliver from TD Ameritrade. Welcome, gentlemen. Oliver, what's going on with those crazy, crazy markets?
I'll tell you what, a little bit of a quiet week in terms of news flow. I mean, we've got a lot of geopolitical stuff still going on, and we got this G7 meeting that has been turning into quite the drama. But as far as markets are concerned, you basically had a few primary things I think we were looking at here on the TD Ameritrade Network. Largely, it's the continued just kind of push higher in stocks, a little bit of softness. But even when you have a down day in technology, we saw that market participants found a compelling enough case in energy companies and even consumer staples to kind of offset some of those growth losses. A pretty solid day for value on Thursday, which is not something we see a lot of. So I think that should days like those, the more they happen, I think they give a little bit of hope to investors that it doesn't have to be a strictly tech rally. But that being said, as we've been talking about and covering pretty thoroughly for the past couple months, it just continues to be a largely growth-driven, tech-driven, valuation-driven rally that has put the NASDAQ at new highs this week and leaving a lot of the market behind it. So what sort of shoe drops next, if it's surprise from the Fed in terms of what they see going forward next week, or if it's some crazy resolution on the trade front, but that seems increasingly less likely. I mean, I know there's a lot of drama behind it, but there seem to be more and more instances of just kind of hype and not really anything that changes the overall outlook. Company by company, you got to be careful with all the trade stuff, but right now it's growth and it's tech, guys.
Excellent. Kevin, what are you seeing?
Yeah, echoing a lot of things Ali said. I mean, you saw green on the screen for U.S. stocks this week, which was great to see. You know, as he mentioned, pretty much cross-sector wide, which is something that we don't often see a lot of times. It's, you know, tech's up for the week, but, you know, maybe financials are down, whatever it may be. So we're starting to see the participation of the market, so the amount of stocks that are actually contributing to this rally increase, which is definitely a sign of a bit of a recovery that we've been looking for. So that was good to see. One of the things we've been noting, and we talked about this at the beginning of the year, and we might have been a little early on it, but we've been looking at small caps just because of their underperformance back in 2017. And small caps continue to break to new highs, even as these large cap peers like the S&P 500, you know, are making gains gains this week, but still sit below, you know, those highs they made earlier this year. Small caps just continue to rally higher and higher. And so we think that they may be a little bit extended here. You might see them take a bit of a breather, but, you know, longer term and through the rest of this year, we really see small caps potentially being a good play. Strong earnings outlook, a number of different factors that contribute to that. But small caps is something to watch for. And then just touching on, you know, outside the U.S., there's been a ton of talk about, you know, emerging market stocks and really emerging market stocks and bonds, so to speak, general EM markets. But from a stocks perspective, you still see a bit of weakness there, but I think it's important to kind of differentiate what people say when they're talking about emerging markets. Oftentimes, it just gets kind of lumped into this giant basket of EM, whereas you have a number of different regions and a number of different countries within those regions that are exhibiting different price action or doing different things on a stock level. So, you know, one of the things we were watching for this week, you saw Brazil is kind of the latest country to be fighting this falling currency battle, you know, joining Turkey and Argentina earlier this year. So it's you saw some weakness within Brazilian equities. But if you look across the spectrum over the last 3 months or so, there are certain Latin American nations that their equity markets are performing well, like Colombia. So the broader theme there is just, you know, when you start talking about emerging markets, and that's obviously been a hot topic recently, you know, you definitely want to be able to differentiate between not only just the regions, whether it's Latin America or emerging Asia, but also, you know, the potential return dispersion between the countries within that. But overall, yeah, it was a good week for markets, and we're hoping it continues through next week.
Excellent. I appreciate it. And Oliver, I appreciate you being back on this week. Kevin gave us some insight into cryptocurrency last week and wanted to give you a chance to weigh on that as well.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I kind of talk about it quite a bit on the program just because there's so many different ways to sort of get exposure to this excitement around cryptos and blockchain companies and ETFs and all that kind of stuff, futures as well. I would say that we kind of think about a lot is just how some of the excitement around not just cryptos but a lot of different asset classes point to the later stages, and everybody always says is, where are we in the market cycle, blah blah blah. And we talk about economic theory, we talk about wages, inflation, the bull market rally and all this, but what we talk about this week is a bit of a FOMO trade that is not just in cryptocurrencies and not just in this digital market, but there's really a lot of FOMO trades out there, and you see it in everything from a company like Tesla, where you have fundamentals that are very shaky, yet it rallies 7% because Elon gets an inch closer to a goal, and because there's so much excitement around this awesome thing that he's trying to do with electric vehicles. There is a FOMO trade that exists in cryptocurrencies because there's an excitement around what this new technology has potential to unlock. There is a overall trend of bubbly behavior that is, I think, largely exemplified by the crypto market, but you also see it in cannabis stocks at the beginning of the year and the end of 2017. There was a huge rally in all these pot companies, and then they crashed. There was a huge rally in blockchain-related companies, and then they crashed. And then we kind of closed out that discussion by being very sober about it and saying, hey, the last thing here that might be a FOMO trade is the S&P 500, because when we came into 2018, there was a massive retail-driven passive influx that just pushed the S&P 500 basically vertical. So the point is there. I think it goes beyond just what's happening in this market. I'm kind of thinking about this through a market lens, which is the way I always have. I don't think that you necessarily have to throw all your market valuation principles to the wind to try and assess what's going on in the crypto market. I think that there's a lot of exciting things. I mean, look, my favorite movies are tech movies. My favorite movie is Blade Runner, both 1 and 2049. And
aggressive.
Guys, there's no cash, all right? There's no cash. It's very clear that there will be a cashless society, I think, in the future, and everybody agrees on that. But I still think that if just from the market standpoint, there's so much junk across the token market, and you know, when you start moving down the list on CoinMarketCap and when all that stuff gets washed out, which I think everyone in the community agrees is coming, the idea that some of the big coins in Bitcoin are going to be insulated from that is a tough one for me to logically follow. I think you see right now there's basically correlations going to one, and what the market looks like after that event, I have no idea. I'm sure something will be there, but I get the impression there are a lot of people understating that possibility.
And if I could really quickly, I mean, I'll take, you know, try and take a minute here, no longer, but, you know, sitting on the, not necessarily the opposite side, I mean, I'll pin myself as a crypto bull in this conversation for sure longer term, but I think where Oliver and I can definitely agree is that he talked about all that junk being in the space. I couldn't agree more. I think you need this washout of some of these smaller tokens or coins that simply are just there to take advantage of a frenzy or a mania. And even though longer term, the technology is certainly groundbreaking, I you know, put my words behind that, I think it's also being kind of overused for a number of different industries that don't necessarily need, you know, when you think about blockchain in general, it's really just a database, right? And sometimes a much more efficient way or a transparent way or, you know, trustless way in which you can store data. And a lot of these industries are coming out and saying, you know, oh, we're going to put everything blockchain, and this is gonna be the newest, you know, kind of spark for our industry. And in a lot of cases, it's just that simply won't be the case because they're extremely expensive to maintain, and it doesn't make a lot of sense for every single industry out there, every use case that you see. So yes, longer term, you know, I agree with Oliver. I think there's gonna be something that does, you know, kind of wade through this washout that we're gonna have. But I think it is important to acknowledge that there is a lot of junk in the space and a lot of companies coming out saying that they're going to use this technology in ways that, you know, it's probably not even going to be beneficial or maybe even make things more inefficient, you know, for these industries or for these companies. So, you know, just kind of my two cents there on the back of Oliver's thoughts.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Jeff, it's true that you never saw Captain Kirk or Captain Picard pull his wallet out. So
I know it. Yeah, I mean, I like Blade Runner. I got to say, I like Blade Runner, but I want to know where you guys stand in the last 10 seconds on Star Trek. You know, are you a Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Original, or the new Star Trek with Chris Pine et al.?
I hate to say this in the wake of what's happened lately, but I'm a Star Wars guy.
Yeah, I got to go Star Wars OG, though. I got to go the original.
I feel like that was not an option that he was giving you.
Yeah.
It was choosing.
Okay, or choice C, D. Yeah, that's fine. I'm Star Wars, too. I don't like I personally, and this is not an endorsement anything, I personally like the original series.
I'm a big
Han Solo kind of guy. I always wanted to be him, and instead I was like one of the Jawas. So,
rats.
I think we're picking from the best of the best, though, there. You know, everyone agrees. We like both. We're long both.
Good job, fellas. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. You guys. Have a good
Enjoy your weekend.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, George, that was our duo of Kevin Kelly and Oliver Rennick, and it was nice to hear everyone's opinion on Star Wars and Star Trek. And I just want to say for the audience, just to remind everyone that you know, this is for education purposes only. There's no investment advice or guidance being offered on the program. That's just our little disclaimer that we're all just contributing free and independently to provide information to the audience. So great to have them. But we're joined by another great guest. So we've had great guests after great guests tied together with our contributors, George. Noah Zuss, who is the defined contribution reporter for Fund Action, is joining us. And Noah has this broad coverage that he does, and both defined contribution and DCIO asset managers. Noah, how you doing, bud?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for spending a couple minutes with us, or not a couple minutes, you know, some time with us to talk about things that you're seeing on the beat. I think, you know, George, I want to call this segment like We Got the Beat or something. We'll play with the Go-Go's in the background. We'll have to get the information rights.
I don't know if I can endorse that.
Okay. So I could sing it then. We Got the Beat. Noah.
You don't want to hear me sing. That sounds pretty – it's a good theme, but you don't want to hear me sing.
No, not that. We should maybe do like a song contest for retirement plans people or something.
All right.
So Noah, you know, you and I have known each other for quite some time. I know you're hard in the trenches trying to uncover the latest news and bring that to your audience. What's been top of mind for you this week as you've been out there kind of listening and keeping your ears to the ground, so to speak?
I spent a lot of my time this week covering some layoffs at a pretty major asset manager. It comes in the wake of another major asset manager that's also a record keeper, moving their headquarters, actually moving several jobs from one location to another. And just following the second story at the asset manager, just doing some sourcing and confirming some stuff and going from there. Interestingly, the Morningstar analyst who covers the asset manager with the most recent layoffs finds that the company is actually pretty healthy. Their profit margin, their income ratio actually increased to 72% in 17 from 69% in 2015. So despite the fact that they are laying some people off and there's some business changes going on, maybe they're just focusing on one area over another. And I don't think it portends, or at least the reporting bears out, that it doesn't pretend that a sale or a spinoff or a merger is coming. I spent a lot of time on that. And there are also several bond funds that were launched over the week. And they were interesting because they were sort of following a similar strategy to give investors options for fixed income allocation options in a rising interest rate environment. And there was a big appointment at at another firm on a data and analytics side. So that's a growing area as well, with sort of the decline in active management towards more passive and factor-based fund oversight.
So Noah, thanks for highlighting all those issues. And that first, and all the articles that you're referencing can be found on the Fund Action website, and that is
that's right.
You can that's fundaction.eu, is that correct?
It's fundintelligence.global, I believe, /fundaction. You can also find all my articles through my social media on Twitter at NZ32 and on my LinkedIn page.
Great, thanks.
I was curious, Noah, I'm sorry, Jeff, how long does it take for a firm to decide that they want to launch a fixed income fund, for example, and then actually get it up and running?
That's an interesting question. That's a little bit behind the scenes, and there's the old saying about legislation and sausage. You don't really want to see how it's made. It's a little behind the scenes, but I would imagine around 6 months to a year, maybe after a filing. We search a lot of filings through the SEC EDGAR website, and it's hard to put an exact time frame on it because different firms have different strategies or vetting processes. Plus, market factors can influence it. I would think, depending on world events or interest rates, all those kind of factors I think would go into when to launch it. And also, you got to get cleared by the SEC. You got to have all the legal T's and I's crossed and dotted. And it's a process.
Mm-hmm. And I just know from doing manager due diligence that these things are often years in the making, because they, you don't just build a product or a service without understanding what the appetite is in the market. So I think it's a lot of time that between the for gestation and to grow it.
Right. Exactly.
But the question I was going to ask you, Noah, is, around consolidation in the industry. So we've had a big shift to passive investments, and I think you and I have talked about that over the years, shift from active to passive, and I don't know if that's change or what you've seen there, but as a result of some of these dramatic changes, you've got consolidation in the asset management industry, and we can, I don't have to name names. We don't know who they, mm-hmm. what has occurred over the last couple of years, and also in the amount of record keepers have consolidated. Some of the biggest record keepers have done some acquisitions, mm-hmm. and I would suspect that is some of the things that you're writing about, and maybe one of the reasons why you're seeing some layoffs or some changes in how people are thinking about their businesses and moving more towards automation.
I think that's a big factor, definitely. As you and I have spoken both on the phone, through email, and formally in our chats, it's a very low margin business, and the firms, the big guys who have, tens of thousands of participants and, hundreds of billions in AUM are going to be the ones that benefit. There are some firms that are taking a different approach to leverage technology, to use robo-advisor technology in addition to advisors to leverage out some of that stuff. But I think that that's definitely a factor. Interestingly enough, one of the one of the issues that I reported on, as I reported by a sister publication called Fund Operations under the Fund Intelligence Group, reported that the asset manager that laid some people off this week had already partnered with another firm to share back office functions, and I thought that was very interesting. So not only are there mergers and places you know, coming together, but also sharing some personnel and some functions like that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, George, you know, just, you know what that means for people in our, on our side of the business is due diligence and explaining to clients. I think that's the key takeaway is, you know, you've got to really, you know, without offering, I'm not going to obviously offer any advice, but, or guidance here, but, you know, it sounds like if you're a fiduciary and you're overseeing a plan or you're overseeing the selection of investments, you want to make sure you understand all facets, not only the investment strategy, but probably all facets, the operations, how things are, you know, how do they strike a price, all those kind of things I think would be of interest.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely agree. And I think that it is interesting to see what direction a lot of these record keepers are going in. Even though they are taking advantage of great new technologies, they're probably always going to have that human element. And from my experience and the work that I do with smaller clients than some of these bigger plans, people still really want that. So,
yeah. In the last few minutes, Noah, I want to give the audience perspective about, you know, I think people generally understand reporting and being a journalist, but can you talk a little bit about your process and how you go about your day and how you, you know, you're uncovering the stories that matter that we read about in the periodicals? I think that would be really an interesting exercise in like the 2 minutes that we have left.
Sure. When I first get in, I check emails and try to respond to anybody that I need to talk to. And you know, we look for daily articles every day. Either you know, like a fund launch, we do a lot of ETF coverage, and then more my beat is a little more focused around record keepers. And as you introduced me, I'm the defined contribution reporter. So really, any news about any of the big record keepers or largest asset managers in the country or retirement news, I try to get into. Those can be sources either from other media, either from some of the big names that we all know. And then I'll take a story like that and I'll focus it, you know, more on something that our readers are interested in, like retirement news or an asset manager is going after this market, or they hired somebody to be a 403B specialist or a 457 specialist. And those are obviously, I know you know that, the government and nonprofit sector retirement health plans. There's also a lot of national policy issues. On Capitol Hill, there are several bills in Congress right now that are making their way through, and people don't realize how much retirement investing and savings and finance really affect their daily lives. So maybe they think about it from now and then, but it really does exert quite a bit of influence, and increasingly so, because I mean, I don't know anybody, maybe somebody who works for the government or is a longtime police officer or civil servant who has a pension, but I certainly don't. So it's very important that we know not only what the asset managers are doing and the record keepers are doing, but that we stay invested in those things. I just realized that's sort of a pun, but I like puns. That's okay.
That's okay. that was a good pun. So in the closing seconds, we have a very important question to ask you. We were in the last segment, we were talking about Star Trek versus Star Wars. And I guess, do you have an opinion? I mean, I personally like the old series, but you know, the old Star Wars series. But what's your go-to?
I'm so happy. I wanted to jump in right when we started to talk about that.
Okay, good.
Star Trek is a far superior narrative. First of all, when the show was first launched in the 60s, it was a very groundbreaking show. Because it was about, well, first of all, it featured a lot of diverse characters, and it was about sort of a world without NASA or a space program run by certain countries. It was more of a multinational planet that was more accepting of diversity. Star Wars is more of a battle between good and evil, and it's kind of, once you get past that, there's not really that much depth to it. Star Trek is a much more...
I love this.
Much, Star Trek is a far superior and deeper universe.
There it
so
is.
Well, hold on. I want to get just. We have a couple more seconds. So, which do you like? The original series, the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. What's your go-to? Because you're younger than George and I. So, what's your go-to?
I never really got into the Picard episodes. If I was going to watch Star Trek, I would probably watch the old school Shatner version. Even though it is a little dated at this point, it still holds up, and that's a lot to be said for a 40-year-old show. You know.
Wow.
Classic Shatner. Love it.
Classic Shatner. Well, Noah, we thank you so much for coming on. This was your first of hopefully many appearances, and we look forward to having you back in the coming weeks.
Thanks so much, guys.
Have a good day.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
All right. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. That was Noah Zuss, the Defiant Contribution Reporter for Fund Action. Joining us now is Alessandra Melito, Personal Finance Reporter at MarketWatch. How are you, Allie?
I'm good. How are you?
We are doing great. It's been an interesting week in the markets, and Jeff and I have had some great guests on so far talking about the world of personal finance. And I know that you guys were working on a story about Americans and the reliance or non-reliance on inheritance. I was hoping to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it turns out that 1 in 3 Americans say that their financial stability is dependent on receiving an inheritance. So basically, they're just banking on getting money from mom, dad, or any family members down the road instead of perhaps saving for their own futures.
That doesn't bode very well, does it?
No.
that's
given
disappointing.
That, so a couple of weeks ago when I wrote that story, or when that story I wrote was circulating on the web about saving for retirement in your 30s, people were so angry about it. So it appears that people are not talking about retirement, they're not thinking about retirement, and their sense of retirement or what it will be in the future is like, perhaps unrealistic.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was reading through the article, and it said that Generation Z, which is for probably most people don't realize, that's age 18 to 22-year-olds, that 63% of those folks, so even more, obviously, than 1 in 3, are expecting an inheritance and say that their financial stability is probably reliant on that. But that
it's surprising. Oh, go ahead.
No,
yeah.
Go ahead.
You're going to say what I think you're going to say.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that generation, that's what they said about, like, you know, they were expecting to rely on an inheritance, but at the same time, they think that they consider themselves do-it-yourselfers. So there's a disconnect there. I'm not exactly sure why that is. Maybe because, you know, they are also going into student debt, you know, when they graduate, these are the kids that or the adults that are in the midst of going to college and soon to be graduates. So maybe they just think it's hard to do at the moment. But it's weird how they consider themselves do-it-yourselfers, but at the same time, they're like, they expect to get something from an inheritance.
Right.
Or rely on one.
You know, Allie, it's been what I would have to imagine a pretty interesting 30 days for you with being, I guess for lack of a better term, put on the forefront of the Twitterverse with that article that you posted, and now reading about this kind of perspective from young people. Has all this changed your perspective on kids or young people saving money, or is it?
Well, I guess to me, I always expected that people at least thought about it, but it turns out that, or it seems like a lot of people really just aren't. You know, if they're in their 20s, their late teens, or their 20s, or even their early 30s, I heard from some people, and I'm seeing that it's not a thought. Like right now, it's just a matter of paying down debt and just living day to day. I actually just did another story on, like, should you pay down your debt aggressively or should you save for retirement? And even the consensus, what I was speaking with those financial advisors was that, you know, a lot of the times people think that they just have to pay down all the debt they possibly can, before they start saving for retirement. So I have been very surprised to see that retirement is not something that people have, you know, in the forefront.
it's a shame. It really is. But I can understand the debt and, you know, other things. And people deserve to live their life. But I think, you know, if you're not saving in your 20s, I think you're, you know, really setting yourself back a little bit in terms of the power of compounding. I mean, it is the more time you have, it is the time horizon that really can have a major impact on what you have. And then I've seen some studies that, you know, people advocating for working longer, but that may not always be possible, guys. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes, you know, there's automation, there's, you know, employers may not want, there may not be the opportunity to do that. So I think that's definitely a concern there.
Or just medically, you may think that you're going to be very healthy at 60 or 65 or 70, and hopefully you are, but, you know, there is a chance that you might not be. So you may have to retire earlier than you anticipated, and it might not be voluntary. And it's interesting because so in that story, that other story that I did, I cited a TIAA example of two people who both saved $30,000 for retirement, but at different times. So there was Kate. This is the example. There was Kate, who started saving at 25 and stopped saving at 44 when she reached 30,000, and she had the intention to retire at 65, and she was able to have $168,000 at age 65 compared to Andy, who saved the same amount but starting at 45 and ending at 64, and by the time he was set to retire at 65, he only had 50,000. So the compound of interest is very powerful.
Yep, very powerful phenomena.
Yeah, and yet people only say, like, they say that they do want to retire in their late 50s or their early 60s, but a lot of millennials say that they're not saving for retirement until they hit, like, 35 or 36 years old. So it's going to be very hard for them to save the amount of money that they'll need to retire in their late 50s or early 60s if they are only starting in their mid-30s.
And it all depends on what that retirement's going to look like, I suppose, too. So,
yeah.
I guess if I had a choice, I'd have an inheritance, too.
I think that it's as all of us work to try to figure out and crack the code of how to get people to start saving money earlier, certainly putting these ideas out into the ether, even though some people probably responded to you angrily or with frustration, I think hopefully it caused them to at least internalize and think about it a little bit more than maybe they had been. So,
I hope so.
Maybe it's self-frustration.
Well, I think
They're not necessarily taking it out on Allie and her writing. They're just saying, oh, shoot, they looked in the mirror and said, you know what, she's really right. Or whatever, her conclusions are right.
Definitely took it out on me, but that's okay.
That's not nice. But, hey, look, your story went viral, right? Your story went viral, and you wound up on national TV. So, hey, it worked out for you. I have a question as we're coming to the end, towards the end of the segment. I've been asking this all, you know, we just had a great segment a couple minutes ago with Kevin and Oliver. Do you like Star Trek? Do you like Star Wars? Or do you, and if so, which versions do you like the best?
I like both. Okay. I like the modern Star Treks, and I like the older, the original Star Wars.
Luke Skywalker, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, the new movies are cool and all, but, like, I prefer the older ones.
And when you say the newer Star Trek, do you mean the one with Chris Pine or, like, Jean-Luc? Okay, so you like those. Okay, that's very interesting.
Zachary Quinto, I think they have done a really – I mean, I like the old ones, too, but I think they did – the modern ones, I think, have done a really great job of bringing, like, this generation into the realm. So that's been good.
Yeah, those have been good. It's a good franchise. So awesome. Well, thanks, Allie.
No problem.
And keep up the great work, and keep stirring the pot, right?
Yeah, we like that. And we'll see, and we won't see, and we won't see you next week, but we'll see you the following, perhaps.
Yes.
Awesome.
Great. Well, enjoy your week.
All right.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
That was good.
Yeah.
Okay. So Dave and Kevin. And they're both Skypeys.
Yep.
This is actually going to plan. And I'm going to head to the airport right after this. And
Kevin, what's up?
Wait 1 second while I get this.
Yes, sir.
Guess who's back? Kevin.
Kevin, is David going to be joining us today?
David will be joining us today, yes.
Kevin, are you outside?
I hear you walking, or someone's walking.
No, that's me.
Oh.
I'm about to get inside.
We're catching you off guard because we're actually almost on time.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I know, we're early at this point.
I know, don't say anything. We haven't had technical difficulties.
Not yet.
No, come on now, don't say anything.
Not yet. And I'm surprised, I guess since you're in New York, you haven't had the technical difficulties that everyone in D.C. is experiencing after the Caps win last night.
Oh, man, that was awesome. Are you a Caps fan?
I'm enough of a Caps fan that I was down there watching the game.
It was unbelievable. I'm so excited about that. I forgot to mention that at the top of the hour. Why don't we say that at the top of the segment, George?
By all means.
Wow, you walk really with a purpose.
I'm a loud walker. I'm a bit of a stomper.
Sounds like you.
Hello.
David, hello. How are you, sir?
It's ringing, actually. It's really weird.
Technical difficulties.
Yeah, can you do me a favor?
Yep.
Can you hang up on me and dial me back?
Sure.
Sure.
All right. I'll call everybody back. Welcome back, everybody. That was Alessandro Melito from Market Watch. Joining us now, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group. Sure that you guys are, number one, really enjoying the aftermath of being Stanley Cup champions, but also probably dealing with the aftermath of being Stanley Cup champions. So, what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Aside from celebration, we're heading into summer, but Congress isn't going anywhere. So that's what we thought we'd talk about today.
Love it.
We talk about legislation.
Yep, we go straight from NHL crunch time to legislative crunch time.
Good forechecking, guys. Good forechecking.
Well, we could probably keep this going the whole time with the Ovechkin or Eller comments about how great that was. But I think we're going to pivot and talk about kind of what's going on legislatively. So, David, I was thinking the big thing is Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act. But there's also been some action in the House lately. What have you been most focused on?
I definitely agree. I think that RESA is the big story here. I think really the big discussion is what are the themes that are out there? There's three themes in my mind out there, Kevin. One is multiple employer plans, open MEPs. They've been around for years in the discussion and legislation. The Dems and Republicans agree at the high level, but they haven't gotten it through. Number two is coverage, auto enrollment, auto increase, more safe harbors, and even potentially in some ideas, even required plans, or let's we say it, mandates, and how that ties to state plans. Number three is lifetime income. Now, there's a lot of agreement in some ways among different pieces of these among Democrats and Republicans, but the devil's in the details, and that's where I think the real challenge is, especially as you look at all the legislation that's out there at this point. What do you think, Kevin?
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, it seems like there's broad agreement on all three of those big topics, but right now the House and Senate to be battling over whether they want to buy pizza by the pie or pizza by the slice. I think RESA is more pizza by the pie because it addresses open MEPs. It has some of those, the auto enrollment features. and it goes into lifetime income. But when you look at the house, I mean, they seem to want to do it kind of by the slice, where you've got the Retirement Security for American Workers Act, which basically just has open MEPs. You've got the Retirement Plan Modernization Act, which makes changes to the kind of plan design. You've got the Automatic Retirement Plan Act of 2017, which, like you said, essentially a mandate to get people in. But there seems to be a big interest in kind of addressing all three of those big picture items, but a disagreement over whether or not they should all be kind of mushed together or done separately. David, you want to talk a little bit about the open MEPs?
Sure. Open MEPs are definitely a evolving area. In short, since 2012, the DOL said back then you can't do open multiple employer plans, unaffiliated employers. There's real interest in different parts of the market. I think the devil in the details is who's the responsible fiduciary? What's the oversight over them? What level of responsibility do the employers have to monitor? I think there's different views across the industry and among employers here, and I think that's another the devil in the details item. Because the idea of professional and institutionalized management is a great idea, but the real challenge we face is figuring out who's responsible for what, and this is where I think the politics come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting issue. I mean, when I think about open MEPs, I also think about the question of who's going to be running and designing plans going forward. Is it going to still be kind of large plan sponsors or plan sponsors designing their own plans? Or will we move to a system that looks a little bit more like Australia's superannuation, but not totally going there, where service providers are essentially designing plans to try to attract employers, or designing a structure that employers can then opt into?
Should be interesting to see what actually shakes down, right? What I'd like to do is send a bouncing puck your way, just to continue the hockey metaphors. I've been paying sort of close attention to what's going on in Seattle as of late, and it seems like they're adding more and more taxes, and the result of that seems to be people moving out of the city. And I guess to a degree you could say the same about California. Are we watching the precursor to major pension problems within those areas if they cause all the high-income people to actually move out? Or am I reading too far into that?
I'd love to go first on this one. I think there's been some speculation that essentially defined benefit plans, or some of the mandates that have been put in place to encourage retirement savings, have made business environments less friendly. And you can think of some kind of large northeastern states that have run into large deficits in terms of their retirement plans. At the same time, kind of there's a countervailing idea, which is that by offering better benefits, you're attracting a better workforce. And I think we're in an early stage here in terms of figuring out how this is going to shake out. I mean, I personally tend to think that these benefits could prove unsustainable in the long run, which could kind of support your hypothesis that people are going to move out as a result of this. But in other areas, you're seeing kind of a real retention of talent, which drives growth. David?
No, I concur with you, Kevin. I don't have much to add.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, it's just try to make heads and tails on finding the right balance between taking care of people and charging people too much and everything else. So I guess time will tell on that one. So, Jeff, any other questions for these gentlemen before we head into the weekend?
Well, I have a lot of, I'm not going to go too in-depth. I mean, I have a lot of questions, but I think these guys did a great job covering all the craziness that's going on in terms of new legislation. So I appreciate that. And I'm excited about the Capitals. I don't know if I disclosed that I am a lifelong Capitals fan, so I'm used to a lot of disappointment. So I was up very late watching the game. But I do want to say that David and Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. I know they have very busy speaking schedules and client schedules. We appreciate their contribution to the show, and they do that because in putting words in their mouth, but I think they feel really passionate. I know they're very passionate individuals about retirement and savings and helping people do the right thing in order to get where they need to be. So guys, thanks so much for coming on, and we're looking forward to catching up with you again next week. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks for having us on. I think next week we'll focus on the Capitals victory parade.
I love it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
There it is, Jeff. Another great slate of contributors doing an awesome job.
Yeah, they were just...
And I'm going to hang up.
David, thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye, Kev. I'm going to start that again.
Yeah, so another great week and another great bunch of contributors doing a great job.
Yeah, I think I'm just really proud of everybody that comes on. And I think this show is really growing. It's dynamic. I think we are innovating. It was a great conversation. I love the conversation with Amy about innovations. And innovations don't have to be completely new ideas. It's really the passion that goes behind something that really can electrify and change something dynamically. And I guess, I think I'm just excited about looking at where we started this thing 3 months ago, you and I, and with Oliver and Kevin really kicking this thing off, and how it's evolved. And this week's show with Amy and Noah and Beth and Kevin and everybody, Allie, and I don't want to forget anybody, but that's not my intention, but I think I'm just really proud of all the work that everyone's doing to make this really a great successful show and bring their particular expertise for really the only thing they get in return is this satisfaction. I mean, there's no compensation that we're deriving from this. We're all very passionate about this business and our respective disciplines. So that's my takeaway, George.
I love it. I certainly echo those sentiments and certainly want to congratulate you. Didn't realize you were such a big Capitals fan, and let you know also that I am the proud owner of an Al Iafredi Capitals jersey that I got when I was a little kid for some reason. So still have it.
Yeah, number 34. He at one point had the hardest shot in the National Hockey League.
Yep.
Toronto Maple Leafs. I think he also played for the San Jose Sharks.
Wow.
And the Washington Capitals, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I try to keep my, if you don't notice, I try to keep all my allegiances very down low. I'm just the moderator and the host and a contributor. So
love it.
You have a great weekend. I appreciate being able to do this with you and the rest of the team. And I look forward to next week. We've got some great guests coming on next week. We've got someone from the House of Representatives. We've got more people who are covering the beat. So I wish you all the best with your family and celebrating birthday wishes and stuff. So have a great weekend.
You too, man. Talk soon. Bye.
Thanks, bud.